archives by searching for The Mind Cemetery on blogtalkradio.com. Us online at mindcemetery.com. While on our site, you will find our show calendar to see who we will have on as a guest in the near future. Check out the Strange News feed, peruse our extensive archive of past shows in our archive blogs, track UFO activity via the Alien Stalker, and as always, be sure to check out the critically acclaimed, often imitated but never duplicated, mindcemetery.com blog, where you can get information on upcoming shows, information on past shows, and plenty of interesting nuggets and tidbits that are blogged about throughout the week. You can join the discussion in the UFO Paranormal Radio Network chat room on Pal Talk, or call in to ask your favorite hosts and guests questions on our show hotline. That number is 504-273-7379.
And we're live.
Yes, thank you for joining us. You can also join us in the Paul Talk chat room right now and ask us any questions for our guests tonight. And Nicole, how are you?
Have you all ever noticed that Chip is probably the most awkward radio host ever when the show first starts? I'm just saying, this guy never knows whether we're starting or we're finishing, whatever. Apparently I'm supposed to know.
Have you ever noticed that Nicole is the biggest hater in all of co-hosting history? Personally, I don't even know why she's here.
I don't either. I might take a nap.
Oh, you did last week.
And, well, you know, it's a late show. I'm tired and pregnant and hungry.
You look like an old person, like after Wheel of Fortune's on, or as they like to call it, the wheel. You got to go to bed.
I do.
And get up early.
I do. I'm very tired and pregnant and hungry.
And you do love the Wheel of Fortune.
Give me cereal now.
That's your main staple is cereal.
That and taquitos.
Yes, yes. And as always, God forbid if I shut my eyes and take a nap for a second.
Well, I didn't mean to marry the laziest man on earth.
More like the hardest working.
It just worked out that way.
The most beat down.
Anyway, who are we talking to tonight? I don't even know what the hell's going on here.
You never do anyway, so it's always, it's par for the course.
Just tell me we're not discussing, I don't know, any of the boring stuff. Is there something good tonight?
Yes, we're discussing a lot of stuff. But most importantly, we're going to be talking about The World's Weirdest Places by Nick Redfern, and Nick's joining us tonight. Hello, Nick.
Hey, guys.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us.
Sure, not a problem. How's it going?
It's going great, actually, today. It's not too bad. I didn't get killed at work by a bunch of nonsense. I'm not doing on-call this week, so
it's always good never to get killed at work.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I don't know about that, Nick. If he gets killed at work, I get, like, $350,000, so I'm kind of for that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think your stuff doubles if it's on the job.
Oh, I get like $500,000. Yeah. So if he does get killed, you know, God, quote unquote, God forbid, hopefully it is at work.
Yeah, everybody at work's like, oh, I hope nothing happens, or I hope we're not involved in a shooting or anything. I'm like, are you kidding me? I was like, this is the dream come true right here. It's like I've been waiting my whole life for this. But anyway, hopefully nobody in management hears that and thinks that I'm psychotic. But they already do.
You are.
They've already mentioned my show a few times. Well, actually just once, and I was kind of taken back by it, you know, as in what they were looking for, Nick. They were more concerned not about the content of the show, but whether or not I was making any money off the show. So they can call it secondary employment to screw me for not reporting a second job.
Not a dime. Like
I'm like, you idiots, you know.
Not a dime.
Yeah, here I am having to explain what the hell I do every Monday night, you know.
Nobody
else's
looking...
business?
Yeah, hey, thank you.
Exactly.
You think, you know, they make it their business, so I made it awkward as possible. You know, you want to pry?
Good.
You know, I'm going to start asking you if you believe in aliens and ghosts.
Oh my god. So yeah, it looks like stop, nobody cares about your work anymore. So in my ill-prepared manner here, I'm just reading the bio that I got on Nick Redfern, and he actually looks like a pretty interesting guy.
Yes, yes.
He's written a lot, including The Pyramids and the Pentagon Keep Out the Real Men in Black, which I don't know why, but that really appeals to me in the title alone. The NASA Conspiracies and the World's Weirdest Places.
Yeah, that's his latest book put out this
September
year.
2012. Cool stuff.
We're on the ball. Are you getting crushed with requests for radios, Nick, or radio interviews?
With this book, you mean?
Yes.
Well, what usually happens is that the publisher, you know, they're publicity people, just sort of a bunch of stuff. So what it tends to be is that perhaps like about 6 weeks after the publication date, you just kind of running around like a headless chicken, you know, and then it goes pretty much quiet, you know, where there's just a couple of interviews per month until the next one comes out.
They trickle in then at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was talking to Phil Coppins last week, and that's what I was saying. I'm kind of on a Ancient Aliens tear where, you know, for the last couple of weeks I've had people that have been on there or on that show and getting crushed as well, you know, with his new book and talking about doing six different interviews a day.
Well, the way I look at it, you know, it's kind of like if you're a band and you've got a new album out, new CD out, you got to go on tour. It's the same thing. You know, if you're doing anything, you've got to promote it to get the word out.
Definitely. That's it. And, you know, before we really get too much into the world's weirdest places, which, of course, we'll hit, you know, because that's the reason you're here and out here to talk about it, and that's what we'll get going on. But there's some things I'd like to talk about before we get rolling here. One thing I've noticed with you as not only a blogger, but as an interviewee and everything like that, you are not, even though you cover a wide spectrum of topics, you know, like we were saying before the show, I don't ever see you wrapped up into any nonsense. You know, you never, like, say anything stupid that comes back to bite you, like most individuals out here that make wild statements. You know what I mean? It's like I never hear Nick Redfern's name tied into some stupid statement or something getting thrown back in your face.
Well, I usually save the stupid statements when I'm down the pub on a Friday night. You know,
the right place, right?
Exactly. But I think it's always been one of these things for me where, although I have a sort of deep passion and interest in the paranormal, I also recognize that it's a subject that is full of controversy. And the more controversial, it's not enough just to say, you know, this is going on or this is happening without something to back it up. And, you know, kind of like saying the world's going to end on December the 21st of this year. Well, I would never say that, because what I would say is there's a prophecy suggesting that, and this is why the prophecy is believed and how it came to exist. And that's where I kind of draw the line, because the more controversial, you're right, that if it falls through, people never forget it. You know, it's one of these situations where the bigger the controversy and the bigger your statement, the bigger it goes on for, you know, afterwards. And again, it's not a case of me not wanting to talk about controversial things. You know, you ask me anything controversial, if I've got an opinion and a view on it, I'll give it. But what I won't do is sort of, you know, speculate out of the big beyond and make some statement that's just totally stupid to appease an audience or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yes. And that's something that a lot of other guests miss out on. I mean, I could rattle off countless ones that, you know, you can see, you know, where they've been wrong, and then they won't turn around and admit they were wrong, you know? And it's like, that makes it worse for you in the end.
Well,
you know, there's nothing wrong with being wrong, you know?
No, that's right. And I mean, I've done written books, you know, where over time further information's come out and it's made me sort of change my views on this case or that case or an entire phenomenon. But I don't see anything wrong with that, because it's kind of like saying 500 years ago people thought the world was flat and then scientists proved it was round. Well, if you're big enough to say, okay, I was wrong and the world is round after all, and then you can build on that and take something further, well, that's fine. I mean, when we're dealing with stuff that's definitively unknown, there are going to be occasions when
what's my...
I think he lost it.
How do I get in? What's my fucking Gmail?
I don't know what your Gmail is. Mail.mindcemetery.net.
Chip@mindcemetery.net, but my goddamn password isn't working.
I think it's...
Hello?
Yes, Nick, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
We got dropped all of a sudden. We think Joe...
The Men in Black.
There you go. We think Joe's internet kind of went offline there, trying to figure some things out. See if anybody can hear us in the chat room here real quick.
The secret government.
Yes. Alive, Chip.
Okay, fantastic. We're back on. All right. So... Sorry about that before we dropped off. We were talking to Nick about how he never really gets wrapped up into any controversy out there about any statements made, even though you cover a lot of topics.
Well, no, I mean, I'm always happy to address controversy. The big question is, you know, I try not to make statements without evidence to back it up. And, of course, when people make statements without evidence, by definition, you know, they do become controversial. So... I'm always happy to tackle controversial issues, but, you know, I'm not going to come out and say, I've got proof we never went to the moon or whatever, you know, because I don't. You know, I can offer opinions and theories and ideas, which is responsibly what we should all do, and base it on witness evaluation, government files, corroborative data, but not sort of wildly pull some scenario out and, you know, so the troops come in on the March the 5th next year, you know.
Oh, God, yeah. That's a classic one starting up, too. The Russian army training up in Minnesota. I've heard that one out there. Yeah, so it's just good to have someone out there like you that isn't afraid to talk about things and offer their opinion and still not be able to get wrapped up into stupidness out there. And it's really difficult for a lot of individuals to do that, and I don't know why it is. You know, it's just a...
Well, I mean, I can tell you, because, you know, I do a lot of conferences and know a lot of people in the subject, and I can tell you that part of it is that people I've seen researchers who feel pressured into coming up with an answer rather than offering theories. You know, that's why people say to me sometimes they're not sure where I sit with UFOs. And, well, there's a very good reason for that, because we haven't proved what they are. You know, people mistake evidence for a belief system, and I've found some people where they feel their back's against the wall to offer something that goes beyond an opinion or an idea or a theory, and it's presented as fact rather than as a reasonable.
A fan of ghosts at all. I'm the skeptic and total non-believer. I don't believe in anything, but I do like to be scared, and I like scary stories and stuff. So I hear that you have a pretty spooky story that happened in India, and I was hoping you could share.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, yeah, I mean, with the book, what I've tried to do is sort of pick a lot of very sort of unknown stories from around the world and weird places where there's a lot of strange things going on, rather than just going over the same old ones. And even where I have talked about some new, well-known ones, I've always tried to sort of come up with new information and leads and ideas that push things sort of down new pathways. But one of the places that probably a lot of people won't have heard of that I talk about in the book is a place called Bangor in India. And this is sort of like an old ruined Indian city which dates back to the 1500s. And it's located on the fringes of an area of forest called Sariska in the Indian state of Rajasthan. And what's interesting about the city is that, you know, there's a lot of very old cities in India that are highly populated and haven't really changed for hundreds of years. Bangor's interesting because the city itself is still there, but absolutely nobody lives there at all. Literally not a single person. And there's a lot of theories and ideas as to why this city should have become deserted about 300 years ago. Now, the the conventional down-to-earth theory is that the sort of explosion in population, but at the same time an increase in things like disease and lack of sort of viable food sources made people sort of just leave the area for new cities and new towns. But there are a number of sort of existing folklores and legends. They're all slightly different, but they all basically stem from one original story, which suggests that there was sort of an old wizard, evil wizard type of city, who lived in that area prior to the construction of the city, and when the original founders began to build it, he placed a curse on it and said that if anything's built here and people live here, it's all going to end in disaster and tragedy for everybody. And it was after that time that sort of famine set in, and there was a lot of warfare where members of the local royal family were killed and a lot of city people were killed as well. And it seemed like the entire area had been sort of just pummeled by bad luck. And a lot of people did blame it on this occultist, if you like. And the situation from there was that everybody, first slowly and then quickly, you know, as often happens when panic sets in, everybody sort of acts like sheep and they all headed out of town, never to return. Now, today, the city isn't just sort of a ghost town in a metaphorical sense, but people who go there to visit it talk about late at night and in the early hours of the morning hearing sort of busy chattering voices, which sort of hark back to the 16, 1700s when it was a busy, bustling city, as if, you know, the people who died there, as if they were still caught up somewhere in the ruins of the old city to this day.
Nice.
That's creepy as hell. I would hate
that. How big of a town is this, like, population-wise, that was completely abandoned?
Oh, well, I mean, it's actually a city, you know, not a town. I mean, to give you an idea of its size, the number of buildings that are still standing today, never mind how many existed before that, is still more than 10,000. And when we say buildings, you know, we're not talking about mud huts. We're talking about sprawling, big, you know, stone palaces and, you know, places of worship and buildings, houses, shops, that kind of thing. Palaces, marketplaces, temples, you name it. So, I mean, we're talking about like a major city.
And that's incredible because, yeah, India has like a billion people in it, right?
Like, well, yeah, and I mean, yeah,
and
the thing is today,
a city like that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you would imagine that people would move back there and rebuild it, et cetera, but that hasn't happened purely and simply because centuries later, people are still very much superstitious of the area and fearful that if they're that this sort of old tragedy and the original curse is going to loom again and just more bad luck will follow in its wakes.
Yikes, that's pretty powerful right there.
Yeah. That's
pretty powerful legend right there that not a lot of people even know about, man. I'd never heard of it till today, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I chose it was because, I mean, like I said, I mean, there's some place in the book, like Loch Ness in Scotland, that I've delved into quite deeply, but because there are completely new angles on it. But there are other ones like the Indian story where I knew that most people wouldn't know about it at all, you know, and so that's much better than just going over old ground about this place or that place. That's one of the reasons I didn't include one of the most famous places, Point Pleasant, West Virginia, you know, where the Mothman was seen in the 60s, because what else can you say about it that hasn't been said without just repeating from everybody else's books, you know, which I don't like to do. So.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's a good point you brought up, being able to cover so many topics like you do. Do you find it hard to find new material or anything for the topics?
Not really. I mean, sometimes what will happen when I'm writing the books is that the publisher says, hey, Nick, you know, have you got any new ideas? No. Other times they come to the author with the books, like with this one, The World's Weirdest Places. I mean, the publisher asked me if I was interested in writing it because they'd done a couple of earlier books, The World's Most Haunted Places and The World's Creepiest Places, and they wanted someone to do The World's Weirdest Places. And I said, well, yeah, sure. So, in other words, this book wasn't a case of where I had to sort of pitch it to them and go out and look for the information. They gave me the title of the book and the central theme or the general theme of, you know, we want something that's going to cover lake monsters, ghosts, UFOs, conspiracies, Bigfoot, haunted houses, you know, the whole lot. So then it was a case of them saying, well, we're at 25 places, it's your choice of where you go. So then it's a case of just looking for it. But sometimes, you know, it's me who comes up with the ideas and pitches it to them. But the good thing is that when you're delving into so many different weird things, you don't really sort of fall short on new material to find or whatever.
There you go. Nice. And one thing I wanted to ask you before we get into any of the other questions that I had wanted to hit before we, had difficulties mm-hmm. there. Bigfoot.
Mm.
What do you... Well, I'll just preface it with this. I made a post about the DNA from the Russian Yeti that they produced and analyzed and all that stuff. I put a post on my Facebook page and talked about what some of the scientists were saying there and about the analysis of it. And I thought, you know, some of the statements from the quote-unquote scientists were really stupid, you know, kind of thing. He's like, check it out. 60 to 70% sure this Valentin Supanov, a professor at State University in St. Petersburg, told the Moscow Times that certain that the hair belongs to a Yeti-like creature. And I immediately went to, what the hell is a Yeti-like creature? Okay? You know? Would you at least define that before you make a statement like that, you know? And with me and Bigfoot, the believer slash investigator slash kid in me wants this to be true. You know, I want a 7 foot, 400 pound ape man beast to be living in the woods, swinging from vines, doing its thing in anonymity, you know, without women's involved in it, you know, poking its head every once in a while for a picture or a video, you know. And then the reality slash kid in me says the logistics alone for a beast like this to actually be able to hide from humans, the part where you never see any bones or anything, and I'll get to that too, because I understand that, you know, at one end that they can be, for lack of a better term, smarter than the average bear, and able to elude people and, you know, live in somewhat communities, you know, with each other, or at least small groups or packs or whatever they would call it. I don't even know. That may be a new idea right there, calling it a pack, or, you know, what do you call a group of Bigfoots? I don't know. yeah, a bunch of big feet, you know, instead of like, a herd or whatever. It's like, you know, at one instance, they're able to, you know, hide from everybody, and they're this smart animal slash beast and all this kind of stuff, and yet then all of a sudden they're not too smart enough to avoid contact altogether, number one, build fire or put on a pair of pants, you know? It's like, where's the line drawn in the intelligence of this beast? But anyway, that's just my own getting into the splitting hairs of the whole thing. And basically the gist of it is that's where my belief system comes down with it. Love to have this thing be real, and I'm not even against going to look for it. It's just, you know, when you see a show like Finding Bigfoot and Moneymaker and all that kind of stuff out, and that guy out there doing this stuff, it's just, I think they end up doing a disservice more than anything, because, you know, you're out there using terms like, oh, this area of land is very squatchy and all that, you know, you're just making it look
squatchy.
You know, you're making yourself look bad eventually, and it's like, damn it, I kind of want this to be true, but you're making it hard for me to explain to my friends at work, you know?
So, no, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, well, it actually sounds like you've been reading some of my blogs, because, you know, I when I was a kid, I used to believe that Bigfoot, it was all black and white, that Bigfoot was just some sort of unknown ape running around the woods and forests of America, and then the Yeti was like an equivalent in the Himalayas, etc., etc. One of the things that sort of certainly began to change by the time I was like 25, 26, was the realization that, you know, these creatures, and I don't just include these, I mean, a lot of so-called cryptids, unknown animals, they have several things in common. One is that they look like normal animals, but everything about them is totally kind of, just doesn't make any sense at all. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And basically, by that I mean that they're seen in areas where we should be able to catch one, where it shouldn't be impossible to shoot just one.
Yep.
But also where there's not enough food, there's no cover, there's no evidence of living habitats, no evidence of sort of reproduction and children, babies, whatever. It's just like Bigfoot manifests and then it's gone. And yet the witnesses are highly credible for the most part.
Yep.
And my view is that Bigfoot is a real phenomenon. But I don't think Bigfoot is just some large lumbering ape that science hasn't classified yet, like a... you know, the equivalent of a next mountain gorilla that, you know, we just haven't found. I think there's something weird, very weird about Bigfoot. I think it's real in one sense, but I'm sort of more inclined to go with the sort of theories that people like John Keel came up with, kind of like window areas where these things can zip in and out of our reality from somewhere else. Now, to what you're talking about earlier about making rash statements, I'm not going to say, I don't believe it's true, I don't believe Bigfoot is some pet of the space aliens or whatever. But I do think there is a very good chance that Bigfoot is highly evolved, and the fact that it looks just like an ape, our tendency, our ego, is to think it's dumb and stupid because it's hairy and tall and looks like an ape. But I think it's a highly evolved creature, and I think this creature can, I know this sounds controversial, but I believe it is something like this, that these creatures enter our world through something like portals, wormholes, for whatever reason, and they have skills and talents far above and beyond ours. And I think that explains why their presence here is so fragmentary and elusive and here 1 minute and gone the next, because they literally are. And I don't believe they live here, feed here or anything. What this other realm might be, you know, I just don't know. But I think there are enough cases on record where people have said they've seen Bigfoot kind of winking out of existence in a flash of light or just fade away. There are enough cases like that from credible people to suggest that we haven't really hardly touched upon, you know, what this creature really is. But it is something.
Yeah, you know, and you made some real good points about there being great witnesses out there, credible witnesses, and in the scenario that you put out there about, you know, it being something that could be interdimensional, makes more sense because a long-term, a long-term footprint of the Bigfoot, you know, in the environment, it would have been discovered by now. You know, so
no, you're right.
Has
that's
to
have
it going in and out, you know?
Yeah, that's the big problem, is that an 8-foot-tall creature, or creatures, I mean, we'd have to have a massive colony or viable population to allow for, you know, continued growth and reproduction. But when you have so many reports, particularly near to big cities, I mean, I live just outside Dallas. I can drive less than an hour and be in an area where Bigfoot's been regularly, 8-foot-tall, and yet we can't catch him an hour from Dallas. You know, there's something wrong when that happens, you know.
Yeah, out here in North Carolina, we got the Ouray Forest about an hour away from us here in Raleigh, you know. So, yeah, I was just wondering where you sat on that because, you know, I see a lot of posts out there, especially, well, I should mention a couple of your websites out here. There is the nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com and nickredfern14.blogspot.com. And also my favorite is There's Something in the Woods. I like that one. I've had that one on the on the feed for Google Reader for a while.
Right, cool. But I mean, it's one of these situations where, I mean, a lot of sort of mainstream cryptozoologists, you know, I'm good friends with them, but we disagree on just about everything. You know, it's like when I start talking about Bigfoot dematerializing, you know, certain cryptozoologists, who I'm good friends with, but they're like, oh, God, you know, Nick's on one of his weird tangents again, you know, which is true, but I don't apologize for the fact that there are weird reports. And if the witnesses are saying they saw this happen or this creature vanished, you know, you've got to follow the story. It's no good just firing these stories away or hiding them because it doesn't fit well with belief systems. You know, that's as bad as the government hiding the truth about UFOs, you know, if we're guilty of doing the same thing. So...
Yeah, that's, you made a good point there, is that, you know, the good friends that are, you know, cryptozoologists, researchers into this, and it's it's something I don't like touching, you know, with a lot of them, because I don't want to get them upset. Because
I don't care. Yeah. It doesn't bother me if somebody disagrees with me. You know, sometimes having a good old argument, particularly on air, can be sort of really entertaining, you know what I mean? If you've got a couple of guests on and they're screaming and shouting at each, that's good fun. But the thing is, we should also be sensible enough to realise we can sit down and have a couple of beers together and disagree on what some huge lumbering creature in the woods is without sort of breaking each other's jaws, do you know what I mean?
Exactly. You know,
although sometimes that might be the preferable outcome, who knows?
There you go. And that's good, you know, and that's the best part about having rational friends out there in the field that don't ostracize you or get into knockdown dragouts forever with you and respect your opinion, you know what I mean? And that we can all bring something different to the table and different opinions, and it doesn't mean I have to sit and continually bash you or laugh at you because you're going out in the woods, because God knows I'd like an answer as much as you. It's just you're determined enough to get out there and do it, you know?
So, well, you know, I've always been of the opinion that if you're going to investigate anything, it's best if you can. I mean, granted, not everybody sort of has the time and ability or even location to go where a lot of these reports surface. But if you do, I always feel it's better because it's like anything in life, you know, if you want to find it, you've got to go looking for it. So that's what I've always tried to do, you know, where possible. I mean, obviously America's a hell of a lot bigger than Britain, where I'm originally from, and it's not always the easiest thing to travel from Dallas to, say, Seattle, you know. So.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of localities there that aren't even up for that kind of thing. And that's a good point about Bigfoot in Britain or anything, because you've also got some action out there in the Berwyn Mountains, black hounds, lake monsters, UFO crashes, stuff like that going on. Can you talk about the Berwyns?
Yes, sure. Well, the Berwyns, it's a very large mountain range in North Wales. And, you know, mountains often do sort of attract a great deal of paranormal, folklore, phenomena, stories. And the Berwyns sort of typifies that. I mean, a lot of people, if not all your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of the Sherlock Holmes novel, The Hound of the Baskervilles, which was written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Well, Conan Doyle wrote that book because he'd heard existing legends and stories of sort of these ghostly black hounds with these blazing red eyes that were sort of perceived as being kind of Grim Reaper type characters. If you see one, it meant sort of death or tragedy for you, or somebody in the family or a close friend was going to quickly follow. And people would report seeing sort of packs of these spectral hounds flying across the skies, and it would be, as I said, you know, being disaster for that person. And a lot of people claim to have seen these ghostly packs of hounds flying high over the mountains, the Berwyns. And if you ever see the Berwyns, you know, they look like a really imposing mountain. We've seen some old black and white horror film, you know, and that's literally how they look. And so if you imagine a pack of glowing-eyed red hounds sort of fiercely, sort of spectrally flying through the sky, you could sort of understand the fear that it created. But that's not the only sort of weird thing in residence on the Berwyns. Just a bit short distance from the foot of it, there's a lake called Lake Bala, which is a very deep lake. It's Bala. And in the same way that Loch Ness is the home of the Loch Ness monster, Nessie, Lake Bala is home to another sort of enigmatic lake monster called Teggy. And all sorts of theories have been put forward that could it be a gigantic pike? Could it be a giant eel? Is it just some sort of monstrous fish that we don't even know what type it is? So, you know, it has its resident monster story, resident ghostly black dogs. But it was also a site, the mountains themselves were the site of a very weird incident in January 1974 when something reportedly slammed into the side of one of the mountains in the range itself. It was January the 23rd, 70. And a lot of people living locally in the little old villages in the area reported seeing these strange lights in the sky. Others reported what sounded like something slamming into the mountain, you know, like an impact shake and the sound. And so mountain rescue team people went up there Royal Air Force sent planes over and helicopters to scout out the area. The official story is that nothing was found, and the Ministry of Defence and the British government don't avoid talking about it, but they say that the weird lights in the sky were meteorites, and the feeling of like a shudder and an impact that people reported was supposedly an earthquake. But it was kind of weird that if that is the case, that the earthquake should appear at exactly the same time that the meteorites re-entered the atmosphere in the same location as well. And since then, various sources from the British military have come forward to claim that some sort of UFO crashed on the mountainside and that alien bodies were recovered. So it makes it kind of like a Welsh Roswell, if you like. But it's intriguing that all of this stuff is just focused on this one particular range of mountains.
I didn't know that. Is that what you would consider the UK version of Roswell, or are you going to stick with Rendlesham, maybe?
No, I mean, Rendlesham for me, I would only consider Rendlesham sort of on a par with Roswell because of the credibility of the case in terms of the credible witnesses and the sheer number of witnesses as well speaking on the record. But, you know, Rendlesham was more of a landing, so if you're going to sort of apply a crash scenario, the Berwyn story is probably the most intriguing one. And it's interesting because it has so many different angles. There's the UFO theory. There, as I said, the meteorite slash earthquake theory. There's also the story about sort of a military plane carrying an atomic weapon or something like that, and then the government hiding it all under like a smokescreen of UFO crashes and earthquakes. You know, there's a bunch of different theories that all go in different directions, but all sort of variously conspiratorial, if you like. So that's what makes the story so fascinating, that not only is it sort of an intriguing story, but it has having all these different strands. It's a great, from a storytelling perspective alone, you know, it's a great story.
Yeah, that's for sure. And you want to talk about controversy laden. Woo! The players in that story, you know, are coming at you tooth and nail and vicious, you know. And I'm a big fan of Sasha and Larry and Peter, and I'm on their side in that whole thing because I don't see a whole lot from a couple other individuals that could be, at least in the long term, that's come out to be consistent or even remotely close to civil, you know? And I don't dig that aspect of the whole case there, but it's like you said, though, there are a lot of strands of individuals that are involved in that, and it seems like everybody's, you know, a couple of them have a lot of problems with what other people have said, you know.
Well, I think it's like in a lot of significant cases, UFO cases, where the military is involved, what I found is that suddenly a lot of different stories and scenarios and situations surface in relation to the case, where suddenly you've got five or six different theories, and I think this is done sort of subtly and officially by military or intelligence agencies because they know, you know, they're not Superman. They're not, if a significant incident occurs, they know the story's going to leak out. So if they can't stop it leaking, what they do, they swamp the field with a bunch of conflicting other stories. So people are left with their heads spinning. It's kind of like Roswell. You've got the UFO story, the women bodies, you know, and so on and so on. So, again, it's like the government knew it couldn't hide the truth about Roswell, so if you can't hide the real story, whichever one it might be, you flood it with seven or eight different stories and have everybody chasing around like headless chickens and the government hoping that the real story just stays deeply buried.
Exactly, and that's an aspect of Jim and John's story that I wholeheartedly believe in. Because, you know, the stuff they talk about with their debriefing, quote-unquote, and the chemicals they were given, you know, post-fact, and the different things they were throwing out, that kind of stuff, and that also Larry was subject to, you know, that all is right up that alley, like you said, of complete disinformation, misinformation, confuse the hell out of people, you know?
And unfortunately, it works because because sometimes, even if the military people themselves who are involved, if they're fed a fake story and they don't know it's fake and then they relate it, they come across as really earnest and honest. And from their perspective, they are. You know, even they're not aware they've been duped. That's when you get into really confusing areas of not knowing where, you know, the truth lies. But I mean, with Rendlesham, there's clear evidence for me that anyone who says it was just a lighthouse and people mistaking things in the woods, I mean, that's just total nonsense, you know. That's just the most bizarre thing I've ever heard.
Might as well start calling it swamp gas while you're at it, you know.
In England, you know, will-o'-the-wisp type stuff, but that, you know, not in Rendlesham Forest, where somebody actually tries to jump on a triangular-shaped machine, you know, or touch
it. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, I was definitely wondering about that kind of thing with you, because I know.
But again, I mean, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Rendlesham, the reason I included a chapter in the book on that wasn't just because the UFO case is so famous, but Rendlesham also is home to a lot of other weird mysteries that leads me to think that, you know, maybe even the UFO phenomenon, maybe it's not extraterrestrial, perhaps that's sort of interdimensional, you know, and that Rendlesham's a kind of window area, because we also have reports of these ghostly, fiery-eyed black dogs from Rendlesham. There's also a Bigfoot-type creature being seen in the woods, which goes back centuries, known as a Shug monkey, which is S-H-U-G. And Shug is a sort of a distortion of an old English word, skooker, which means demon. So it basically became known as the demon monkey that lurked in these woods. There have also been large, big black cat sightings in Rendlesham Forest. And just down the road, where you have the famous lighthouse that the skeptics say was responsible for the UFO sightings in the town of Orford, well, about 800 years ago, there was a story of a so-called hairy wild man caught off the coast of Orford. So that whole area is just sort of steeped in just general weirdness.
Yeah, that's a good point. They brought up the general weirdness of everything. Now, with all this general weirdness out there, well, shoot, I'm going to wait until we come back, I guess, because I got a good follow-up with that. With a lot of these things, which some people would categorize in their own right, and I think make it too simple, but it's their prerogative to do that kind of thing, and I'll touch on it when we come back from our break, because we are at the top of the hour here, and I want to hit our break for you, even though we ran into some snags. Let's try to keep some kind of consistency, for the love of God, right? So, Nicole, you still with us?
Yes.
Well, it's amazing you're not asleep yet, thank God.
I know. Well,
what would I do without you?
You bring an interesting awake. So, Nick actually was able to bring it tonight. I don't know who was on last week, but I didn't care for it.
Wow, you're horrible.
I am.
You don't do a whole lot of talking as the skeptic non-believer. Yeah, it kind of wraps it up real quick there, Nick, when she's around, right? You get not a whole lot of convincing to someone that can't even, you know, tolerate anything.
Well, it's best to say it how you feel it, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're going to take our break for about 10 minutes here. If Joe back at the studio can help us out and play us out, we'll be back. We're joined by Nick Redfern for our first hour. We'll be back for hour number two here in about 10 minutes with Nick Redfern talking about the world's weirdest places. Ugh, spit it out, idiot, right? The world's weirdest places. Sometimes he gets it right. And we'll be back in 10 minutes for another hour with Nick, and talk to you then.
Are we clear?
Yeah,
yep.
I think so. Yeah, we good? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Here we go.
I'm just going to go and grab a drink. We've got about 10 minutes, did you say?
Yeah. About 10 minutes.
Right. Okay, I'll just be a couple of minutes. I'm going to make a cup of tea.
Take your time.
There you go.
Okay.
blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway. MindCemetery.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to hour number two of the Mind Cemetery with your hosts, Chip and Nicole. The phone lines are open and the number is 504-273-7379. You can join the discussion in UFO Paranormal Radio Network's Pal Talk chat room with our guests, the hosts, or give any feedback you'd like. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Visit our website, mindcemetery.com, for upcoming show news and blogs.
So welcome back to the Mind Cemetery. I'm here live. Nicole has wandered away for a snack still. We have Nick Redfern rejoining us for a second hour. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Good, all refreshed, hopefully.
Yeah, just got me a nice cup of hot tea.
Nice, there we go. That'll do it. That'll do the trick. And Nick's here with us. We're talking about his newest book, The World's Weirdest Places. Did it without a stutter or a stammer this time, so that always helped. Like I was teasing for a little bit, before we were leaving, what I was going to talk about was see what your opinion was that I guess it's Christian fundamentalist view on a lot of paranormal activity or UFO activity and how they simplify it by just saying, well, it's all demons. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, in your work and all the books that you've done, how often do you run into that kind of opposition to anything?
Well, I mean, you get it all the time, and often it's not done consciously. I mean, it's kind of like with the Bigfoot community, that when, you know, you talk about sort of fundamentalists saying that UFO activity or whatever is all demons, well, very often with whole swathes of the Bigfoot community, it's the same thing, but the analogy is, oh, it's just a giant ape. Or with UFOs, it's just aliens, you know, from this star, from Zeta Reticuli or whatever, you know. And it's kind of like all of these different realms or paradigms or groups or beliefs all have their very rigid ideas as to what's going on, and they're very much unswerving or unchanging. And, no, this is what it is, this is what it isn't, you know, that kind of thing. And I've never really got that. I've never felt any need to have to sort of pigeonhole myself into this camp or that camp when we don't have all the evidence. That's why I don't understand why someone can say, you know, it's a literal demon from a literal hell, when we can't prove exactly what hell is or isn't, or if there is a hell, or is it just an ancient term for like another dimension. You know, I would be... People who sort of so rigidly into belief systems sort of annoy the hell out of me, because how can you hold a view so rigidly when you don't have proof of it? That's the thing. I think there's enough proof that Bigfoot exists, but there's not enough proof to pigeonhole it into a specific belief system. That's the important difference. That I don't care what anybody believes, providing they acknowledge that it's a belief and not a hard fact until we can prove it.
Yeah, and you know what's even crazier, a term crazy gets tossed around a lot, but it's the easiest way to describe it, I guess, is that, like you were saying, there's people, you know, the fundamentalists will sit there and tell you up and down that it's a demon from hell, and for some reason that's acceptable, you know, but to actually be, you know, a spirit or an alien or Bigfoot or, you know, Loch Ness Monster or, like you said, the hellhounds and the cats that stuff's just too wild at that point, you know. Yeah. We can't have that, you know.
No, and I think that, again, that's sort of an unfortunate situation, because it's like one rule for one and one rule for the other.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like do as I say, not do as I do, or whatever, that kind of thing. And I think, again, what it shows me is that belief is a very powerful tool. And there's nothing wrong. As I said, I don't care. I'm not angered or affronted or whatever that people have belief systems
yeah.
in the slightest. But I just wish I would recognize a belief system for what it literally is. It's a belief. It's not, you know, it's kind of like I don't need to believe in Canada. I know Canada's there. You know, that's the big difference.
There you go.
But to believe in, I don't know, the idea that this or that, when it's something to do with the paranormal, we need to recognize it's a belief until we can prove it's something else, you know. And that's the stumbling block we're up against in so much of this stuff.
For the record, I don't believe in Canada.
They believe in you, though.
No, they don't.
You're their much violent brother, is what you
I have a couple clients from Canada, and I'm slowly trying to characterize all Canadians. And I think very chill people. They're very relaxed. You know, it's kind of like, whatever. So I don't believe Canada actually exists.
I believe the zombie apocalypse is coming.
I also believe that. We share the same...
I hope. I hope it's coming.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to... I love zombie stuff, and particularly things like The Walking Dead, so I've got it all lined up as to, you know, I'm going to raid the local stores and get stocked up for when it all kicks
in. Did you watch it last night?
Yeah, I did. I watched it, yeah.
I cried for 30 minutes after the show.
Yeah, it's like, I like the show. Because you can never guess who's going to get killed next week.
I came upstairs and cried, and then went and got my son and brought him into bed with me and him while I cried. I was so sad last night. I'm obsessed with that show. I'm obsessed with all zombie stuff, though.
Well, you know, I'm not sure... I'm not sure she's actually dead, because all we heard was the bullet. You know, it's like, what if the son just fired against the wall in anger, and she's actually going to start, you know, maybe the starting moms are next week, she's going to come staggering out the prison with her entrails hanging out or whatever, you know.
I have a problem with this show, though. Do these people not know about infection? There's no way Herschel is getting his leg cut off without, like, hospital-grade antibiotics and living through that.
Well, then again, it depends how quickly the virus travels up the body. Yeah.
No, I'm not even talking about the virus. The hell with the virus. No. I'm just talking about, like, normal little infection.
Oh, it's chopping his leg off.
Staph, yeah. Staph infection or something. Like, you cut his leg off in a prison, on a dirty floor with a used axe.
No. See, they didn't...
Antibiotics, he's fine.
They didn't preface anything in the series yet. They've done a bad job of background art this season, and everyone's overlooking it, I think. Nick, have you seen any of the comics or read any of that?
No, actually, I've never been into comic books, but I mean, I love anything with zombies in, you know, provided it's done well. I think the only big mistake they made with The Walking Dead is they should have made it a women's prison. That would have made it much more interesting.
Yes. I agree. No, they've twisted a lot of things around, but I was talking to a guy at work today who was into it, and I was like, you know what, they're ruining some of the storylines for me. And supposedly the axe that they used on Herschel was one that was, like, pre-prepped and cleaned and ready to go in case they needed to use it. So there was no
background to support that.
Well, they didn't tell you that, right?
Oh, okay, that's convenient.
Well, in the comic book, it's there.
Yeah, that's convenient.
There was a relationship between T-Dog and Michonne that completely was not shown, you know?
Ooh,
and, the name. Calm down, Nicole. I know. I've been looking at the Walking Dead wiki and following.
The wiki. So, let me tell you something, okay? I had an infected gallbladder, and I was in the hospital for a week, okay, from a stupid gallbladder infection. There is no way that you're getting your leg cut off and surviving without IV antibiotics.
Well, let me tell you,
just saying.
I've got an infection, too, and,
STDs don't count.
Well, the infection's you, so.
That's hysterical.
You know.
Yeah, Nick, I'm with you. I'm all about zombies and vampires. I love vampires, too.
Not the new sort of stuff, like, I can't stand Twilight and all that sort of stuff.
Well,
it's like watered down.
I'm a female, so I have to like Twilight, kind of. It's part of the rules. But I do like old school vampires too. Everything from Interview with the Vampire to Fright Night, all those old like 90s and 80s movies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about it.
I like the Blade movies. I thought they were pretty good.
Blade was awesome, dude. I wish they'd come out with more Blades.
Yeah, I like those, and I quite like the Resident Evil ones. I know they're all kind of the same, but.
Yeah.
And 28 Days Later, that was a good one, wasn't it?
28 Days and 28 Weeks. I like both of them, but they both make me cry because they're depressing.
Oh, everything makes you cry, and I'm so sick of you crying over everything, for God's sakes. And by the way, in The Walking Dead with Laurie dying in that scenario, which I think she is dead there, even though we didn't see anything, but it's not like we can't really see. Yeah, we can't really see a kid shooting their mother in the face, okay?
Yeah, you know? That's why I think she's going to come staggering out at the start of the next one.
I would love it. I would love it, actually. But in the comic books, the governor and the Woodbury people end up assaulting the prison and killing a lot of the people there, and during that whole assault, there's a woman that ends up shooting Lori and the baby. So the writers twisted it around to where you won't get to see a baby getting shot, basically.
Okay, because nobody that cares about ratings is going to publish that. It's never going to happen.
It's never.
So did happen in Dawn of the Dead.
Somebody
in the shopping mall.
Yeah, but that's not a cable TV show.
No, that's true, I guess.
AMC is just coming off their big Mad Men money stint here and like just venturing popular over the last couple years. They're not about to take that kind of risk yet.
They've got Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Walking Dead money. Okay, they're not going to screw it up now. They built an empire, basically.
Too controversial. We can go blood and guts. We're not going to push the borders too much. We're not HBO here, people.
And in the comic books versus the show, T-Dog, he's called T-Dog in the show, but in the comic books it's Tyrese. And when Michonne shows up, well, Michonne actually never ends up in Woodbury like she is now. It's always been in the prison. So that's another part of the story that's been skewed.
Well, I suppose that happens a lot, you know, when they transfer either a book or a screenplay, you know, to a fully-fledged movie or TV series. There's always, changes that get put in there. So.
Supposedly we're going to get an entire episode with Michonne, but I don't know about her backstory, at least, but who knows. But just to spoil everything for you since you're here, the pets that she had were actually, one of them was her boyfriend, and the other one was her boyfriend's
friend. Okay, they
said
that on the show, though, Chip. You're not supposed to.
No, they didn't, did they?
Yes, they did, yeah.
When? Oh, no. They didn't say, those two actually killed Michonne's kids, actually.
Oh, that they didn't say.
Yeah.
But nobody cares about comic book world. It doesn't line up with their world. Can we get back to Nick's books here? Because I think derailing his interview, totally.
No, I don't
about
care.
Zombies.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Nick. How many times are you being derailed like that, though, during an interview?
I don't mind if it's like a good thing, like zombies.
There you go. Nice. See, it's a little different.
If it's the weather or something, that's a bit different. But zombies.
Well, weather is news. I can't stand it. Weather is news. My God. Yeah, it's wet and it's windy. I get it, Go home. Stay home,
I shall be well prepared, though, if the apocalypse does happen,
I'll
get on the roof and blast him in the head, take him down first each time.
I'm ready, I'm ready as well. We're canned fooded up and ready to go, Not as much as I'd like, at least, but, in my prepping experience, when I finally realized when I bought about 1,000 rounds of bullets for an AK, right? And so I get, so here, okay, I'll get 1,000 rounds, right? You know, I'll be set. So I get it in a giant can, you know, like a 50 caliber, you know, military can, right? And I dump everything in there. And then I pick this son of a bitchin' can up, okay? This thing's like 75 pounds, okay? At least 45, all right? And I'm like, I can't carry this anywhere, you know? So it really kind of defeats the purpose. I need a small army, basically, to support. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs their small army unless you're just going to run solo, because the logistics are a nightmare, you know? I never thought of it until I actually had it in my hands. And I was like, oh, God, you know?
Yeah, I never thought about that either, actually.
Yeah, what most people, though, do is just end up burying it at certain locations on your way out of town type thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And just pick up some along the way type stuff is what a lot of bug out people do and stuff. And I was like, nah, now we're talking. Now I can handle that. I'll just stick it in the ground and hide a shovel somewhere so I can pull it out later. But yeah.
Yeah, I have to write all this down.
Yeah, the logistical nightmare. Same thing with the canned foods and everything. It's like, you know, you got to get a massive truck to get the hell out of town, you know? Mm. So that's going on a Hummer, you know? And of course, Nicole hates the Hummer, you know, so.
It's tacky and gets bad gas mileage.
Yeah, but it's going to save your ass in the zombie apocalypse, and then you'll be loving it. Then I'm going to pull an Otis on you, and I'm out of here. You know, no?
No. No.
Okay.
Back to Nick, please. Nobody cares about your life.
Okay. The Japanese version of the Bermuda Triangle. Everybody knows about the Bermuda Triangle and people getting lost in there. But in the Devil's Sea out there, you can go ahead and talk about that. Is there any differences or similarities between the actual Bermuda Triangle and the Devil's Sea Triangle there?
Well, you know, it's always a controversial thing because when you're dealing with, you know, sort of large areas of ocean, people are not used to it. Whether pilots or sailors, they can get lost and disoriented quite easily. So I think we always have to be careful when we look at places like this. But the Devil's Sea, which is just off the coast of Japan, actually about 62 miles south of Tokyo, it's kind of very similar to the Bermuda Triangle in the sense that both aircraft and ships have vanished there for years. Where it kind of is more intriguing than the Bermuda Triangle is that in, you know, off the coast of Florida, those stories only sort of date back, for the most part, you know, the large-scale stories, the last 60, 70 years, and prior to that, just a couple of centuries. But off Japan, I mean, they date back more than 1,000 years. And back in ancient Japanese folklore, the story was that all these sort of large ocean-going ships, you know, like the equivalent of ancient pirate ships or whatever, they were being dragged down by giant sea dragons. And, of course, Japan, you know, has a long history and culture of dragon lore and folklore. But what's interesting is that the people of that era and period, you know, they realized there was something weird going on. Now, whether, the, you know, it was all due to sea monsters or something else, they knew there was something weird about the area. So that in itself is a reason, for me at least, to take these stories seriously of it being a strange realm, if you like. But, I mean, through the Second World War, the Japanese pilots were talking about the sky changing and all sorts of weird stuff going on. So, in that sense, you know, it is sort of like a Far East equivalent of the Bermuda Triangle.
There you go. Nice. So they'd avoid that location when they're flying in their flight path and everything as well?
Well, I mean, they don't, in the same way that people don't in Bermuda. You know, it's not like, I mean, for, you know, entire airlines, the Bermuda Triangle is a no-go area. There are probably thousands of people every day who fly through it, not realizing they are flying through it, you know. But it is a case that, significantly, we do get reports that are very, very weird, where compasses spiral out of control, where people get totally disoriented. I mean, there's the famous case of Flight 19, which occurred in 1945, when a whole squadron of Avenger, U.S. Navy Avenger aircraft, just got totally lost, disoriented. You know, we don't know to this day if they ditched into the ocean, if they got swallowed up by some wormhole, or what happened to them. But, you know, they're composite. They flew from the coast of the United States and flew east into the ocean. Well, even an idiot would know that if you're flying east into the ocean, if you want to reach land, you just turn around and go west. You know, you just go back the way you came from. So you just follow your compass till you're going in a westerly direction. Eventually, you'll reach the coast of America again. But they didn't even think to do that. It was like their common sense factors had just gone out the window. And that's what a lot of people report, is not just that their compasses go wild or whatever, but they themselves feel confused and disoriented, like they can't recognize the little islands off the coast and the sky doesn't look right and all sorts of strange stuff like that.
Nice. There you go. I've noticed you've had a couple things in the book about Russia, specifically the Caucasus Mountains, and then again in the Kremlin. Let's go ahead and talk about the Caucasus Mountains, and I think this is a reoccurring thing, and we swing back a bit here, but it seems like there's some sort of Bigfoot legend or sightings all around the world, so he's not just stuck in North America, and the Caucasus Mountains isn't left out of it, and of course, I think that's where the DNA study on the Yeti and everything I was talking about earlier took place.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. I mean, everybody knows about Bigfoot in North America and the Abominable Snowman in the Himalayas. Those are, without doubt, the two most sort of famous hairy wild men or ape men, however you want to term them. But most countries have cultures and stories and folklores relevant to these types of creatures. I mean, all across Europe for centuries, there are reports, and even today, there are reports of so-called wild men of the woods. We even still get them in Britain to this day. Australia has the Yowie, China has the Yeren, then there are these other creatures, which I actually think is a real animal that can be proved one day, Orin Pendek in Sumatra. And Russia has one called the Almasty. Now, what's interesting about the Almasty is either the creatures have been reported in very different ways, or there are possibly, and more incredibly, two types of creature in and around the Caucasus Mountains, because one has been described as more of like a Yeti, Bigfoot-type animal. That's to say a large, very large, lumbering, ape-like animal. But other people have reported seeing what sound very much like primitive humans, hair-covered humans, you know, something along the lines of Neanderthal man or Cro-Magnon man, that kind of thing. Now, could it be possible that there could be two unknown creatures, man-like creatures, you know, living in that area? That would be, it'd be fantastic enough in itself to find one, never mind two. But I mean, the thing that I would say about the Caucasus Mountains, like a lot of places that I talk about in the book where strange creatures are being reported, is that even though, you know, I think a lot of these creatures are more paranormal in nature than not, I mean, the Caucasus Mountains is sort of a sprawling, vast, very remote area that really, even to this day, isn't that well traveled and hasn't changed that much, you know, over thousands and thousands of years. It's not impossible that sort of remote areas there could harbor large animals if there's sufficient cover and food for them. But of course, you know, the Caucasus Mountains is a far cry, from, like I said earlier, from an hour outside Dallas, and that's why I kind of place these creatures into different categories. You know, one more paranormal and one very possibly really flesh and blood, you know.
There you go. And in the Kremlin in Russia, talking about ghosts of Lenin and Stalin being around there, and of course the their version of Roswell. You know what I love? I love everything being, like, measured up against Roswell. You know, in every country's version of Roswell. It's like, you know, you can't beat, you know, American Roswell, so let's just see if we can imprint that name on our event, get it some attention.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is true. A lot of countries around the world do have crashed UFO stories. I mean, I talk about this one in the book, sort of a definitive kind of Russian Roswell, if you like. The story is that after the Second World War, when the Russian city of Kiev, which had been sort of flattened by the Germans during the Second World War, it's being rebuilt. There's a story about, like a missile type object, about 20 feet long, supposedly found buried deep underground. And the first thought, quite naturally, was it some sort of German bomb that had failed to explode? I mean, that does happen. I mean, even today in London sometimes, they still find unexploded bombs, you know, when they're digging deep underground from the war that didn't explode. So that was the first thought. until they realized there was no sort of rivets on it or seams or welding or anything. And reportedly, this object was transferred to a bunker deep below the Kremlin in Moscow. Now, whether or not the story is true, that's a big question, but there is no doubt that there are these vast bunkers below the Kremlin, in the same way that there are highly fortified underground rooms and bunkers below the White House. We know they exist. And they're there for totally normal reasons. You know, it's because in an event of a nuclear war or something like that, the cities would just be flattened. You know, civilization, as we know, it would end. And so the only way to really survive, unless you're really lucky, is deep underground. So most major nations at the height of the Cold War started building these deep bunkers. And so it's not impossible that they could have UFO-like materials, you know, in between acting as emergency command centers. So that's sort of the outline, if you like, of the Russian Roswell. But the very fact that it was taken, supposedly, to the Kremlin is interesting because, as you rightly said, there have been a lot of stories about people seeing, supposedly, the ghosts of Lenin and Stalin, two of the sort of most well-known and infamous former Russian premiers. And what's interesting is that both of the stories related to both of them are of sort of spectral sightings of them wandering around the corridors of the Kremlin or poltergeist-type activity, particularly in Stalin's old office, with people reporting hearing and seeing furniture sort of violently slammed across the room and things like that.
Nice, there you go. Now, have they ever, in Russia, have you found any UFO stories or crashes or anything like that where they've actually recovered bodies?
Well, yeah, there's actually, I think there's somewhere like 9 or 10 fairly intriguing stories that, you know, again, they're not on the sort of scale of Roswell because, I mean, getting stories out of Russia at the best of times is difficult enough, never mind when there's like a shroud of secrecy. And I think that's one of the problems. It may not be that the stories aren't as good, it's just that they clamp down on things so much there, you know. But, I mean, there are a number of, I can think of sort of 7 or 8 good stories. But a friend of mine, Ryan Wood, wrote a book called Magic Eyes Only, which included somewhere in the region of like 70 crashed UFO incidents reported over the course of the last century around the world. And I think somewhere in the region of 7 or 8 of those in Ryan's book were from Russia. Stories of alien autopsies undertaken by the Russian military and attempts to sort of reverse engineer the technology and understand it. Sort of very similar to some of the tales we hear coming out of Area 51.
I have a question for you. You know Bill and Nancy Burns, of course, from UFO Hunters, right? Mm-hmm. And their show, Future Theater, that they've done. I heard an interview they did maybe been a year ago. They did with a guy that came on as the name Viper. And he talked about his working at Papoose Lake. Mm-hmm. Out in New Mexico and stuff, and how he was on basically a recovery team. Now, I don't know how to get in touch with this guy or anything like that. Maybe, mm-hmm. you know, you can talk to Bill since you know him, you know, much mm-hmm. more in person than anything else. But I bet that guy would be a treasure trove for you to talk about mm-hmm. a different sites, because he would talk about he would actually go on probably about 5 different recoveries a year, somewhere in that ballpark, if I'm remembering correctly. But they've got it on their archive if you ever want to check it out. Really great.
Okay.
You know, one of the better interviews I'd listened to in a long time, you know, and really interesting guy. And I think his thing was since he was working out there at Area 51, we know about a lot of the toxic waste that was being used out there and how it's not regulated and all that, you know, nasty stuff that's going on out there. He had some sort of skin condition, if I remember, that he had something going on where he had to put some kind of ointment on constantly. And I'm not sure what it is, and I'm just trying to remember as best I can, of course. But if you're ever looking for a subject or if he'd like to discuss that thing, his stuff again, and great guy, great one, great interview there, you know. And he just went away, you know, for a while, and I was like, wow, man, I'd love to get in touch with that guy and see if I can get a hold of him. But, you know, just an idea, and I'm sure you got a bunch of chumps out there giving you ideas just
Bill.
I do, but, you know.
No, I'll check it out, because actually, I've never heard of that story, so I'll definitely check it out. Yeah.
It was incredible. It was a great one. It was really a great interview. Mm-hmm. You know, really gruff kind of voice, you know, just low rumbling, very down to earth, not going to take your BS, don't give a damn if you believe me or not, you know, kind of guy. And I love that kind of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. I really like that. But yeah, it was a really great interview, and maybe, you know, if you possibly would want to talk to somebody, I figured, you know, you'd be the man to do it, you know. So my thing is that with the Russian stories out of Russia, that is, do you ever run into, not only in the fact that it's hard to leak stuff out of Russia because of the, you know, communist regime there, and I know a lot of stories in the U.S. here are based off of misinformation and disinformation like we were talking about before. I would tend to believe that in Russia, being communist and all, they could just straight up get rid of you. You know, they don't have to give a damn about your human rights or anything. We'll just shove you off to the gulag and call it a day, you know, until you die in a camp somewhere, you know.
Well, I mean, it's certainly not, you know, it's not as bad in Russia now as it was when the Soviet Union, you know, was in place. But, yeah, I mean, it's not like the freedom that you have in the West. You know, it's a far cry from that. I mean, you know, sort of Russia, China, Middle East, apart from those areas, you know, everywhere else, whether it's America, Canada, all of Europe, Australia, you know, we all have the same level of freedom. But, I mean, those countries, you know, there really is a clampdown, you know, and I think just having that in place in general makes it more and more difficult. You know, it's not even as if they have to try too hard to hide something when those sort of regulations are in place. I mean, you know, you kind of hear about things now where they're sort of slowly talking about sort of police and the internet here, you know, which is kind of worrying. But, I mean, places like China, you know, there are entire websites that, you know, the people there are just, it's illegal to access them, you know. And we're not talking about anything that breaking the law, you know, just controversial sites that the government doesn't want their people to know about.
Yeah, and that's something that I would expect to hear more about, is just the straight up getting rid of witnesses, you know, instead of having to worry about a cover story, you know, and they could just get rid of the people and that's it, you know. And in China, we actually have a huge amount of listeners in China. That's, we get a majority of listeners out there on, like, I guess Nicole could, she's the tech of the operations here. Are you there? Are they called, like, what do they call it, Nicole? The servers that they run our stuff on because it is so state locked down?
What are you talking about, proxies?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. A lot of, you know, proxy servers and stuff running up there to get things.
Oh, well, that's good. You're getting out there.
Oh, yeah. The UFO Paranormal Radio Network out there is really big out there. And who knows, they may be trying to learn English from us, for God's sakes. You know? That'd be wild. but yeah, there was, let's see. Speaking of Sandy and the storms up there, we were talking earlier because we were getting knocked out early on in the interview in the first 20 minutes there because of a storm down in New Orleans. You have a place in the book for New York City itself and the subways there and the issues with paranormal activity down there. Go ahead and spread that on us, and we're not talking slime from Ghostbusters 2 running through the subways.
No, that's right. There's a lot of weird stuff in the New York subway system, and not just the passengers, you know. I mean, I'm sure everybody sort of heard these sort of legends about alligators in the New York sewers. And although, you know, a lot of people sort of disregard these stories as just modern-day myths, there's actually two or three where it was proved that, you know, people had actually sort of dumped a baby alligator down the toilets or whatever, because they had them as sort of exotic pets and they didn't want to have them destroyed or put in a zoo, so they literally let them loose. I mean, a couple of cases actually have been verified. You know, stories about 14 to 15 foot man-eaters roaming the sewers, those stories haven't, you know. For me, I think it'd be great fun if they were true, you know, it'd be a wonderful story.
Yeah, but
I don't think we can actually rule them out completely, because we do have a couple of stories which we can vindicate. Now, because the New York subway system, you know, being underground, well, if there was ever sort of a major flooding of New York, because so much of the subway system, by definition, you know, it's a subway. The subway system itself, there are extensive sort of sewer systems and emergency areas for, you know, sort of evacuating massive amounts of water. And there are a number of stories of people who claim to have seen alligators roaming the sort of watery sewer type areas of the subway system, which again, you know, if we look at the fact that the regular sewers have been allegedly the site of alligator sightings, it's not that out of the ordinary that, you know, something else could be seen there. Or, I mean, the same sort of creatures could be seen in another part of the system. But that's not the only thing, you know, I talk about in the book. There's a very weird story I got from a guy who actually worked at one of the hotels that bordered on Central Park, and actually very close to one of the subway exits onto the park itself, who claimed to have seen a strange, like an ape-like creature, just very small, like about 3 feet tall, bounding from one of the subway exits towards Central Park, which sounds, you know, totally outrageous. But he was a very, very credible guy, just a normal employee of one of the hotels who said, you know, hey, I was coming off duty or going on to work, I forget which now. And he said, you know, I just saw this thing. And what was weird, he said, it was as if no one else could see it. It wasn't like, you know, somebody had got a pet rhesus monkey which had escaped. He said it looked like a totally sort of shrunk down humanoid figure, very hairy. He said the best way to describe it was like Bigfoot, but shrunk down to like 3 feet, rather than, you know, a little monkey scurrying around.
Yeah.
And he said it was, he actually said he saw it twice, and he felt that because he saw it twice and nobody else did, it was, again, he felt it was actually something paranormal that for whatever reason he could see it and other people couldn't. Which in itself is an intriguing situation, but, you know, it's you get these sort of rogue cases, as I call them, where it's just incredibly difficult to try and apply any sense to them. That doesn't have a bearing, for me at least, on the credibility of the witness. It just means such strange things happen in life that until we understand the science behind them, you know, we just end up with a really baffling story and not many answers.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of things are going to turn up out of the sewer system now, you know, since the storms in Sandy.
Well, you know, I mean, things like that happen, you know, sort of snakes and all sorts, you know, get washed down through the currents. And, I mean, it's like where I'm originally from. About 100 years ago, a colony of wallabies, you know, the small versions of kangaroos, escaped from a private zoo in England. And they actually made their home in the wilds, and because it's impossible to catch these things, people were like, let them run free. And they still live there now, more than a century later, and occasionally people see wallabies bounding through the English countryside. You know, they're sort of the descendants of the original escapees. And that happens a lot, where exotic animals find a way of surviving and thriving in sort of the most bizarre locations for where they should really be.
There you go. Yeah, and that's the problem with a lot of people getting those exotic animals and everything. They end up losing them, you know, eventually.
Yeah.
Or getting rid of them because they don't want to take care of them
anymore. Yeah, they get too big and, you know, and they start looking at you as food then.
Nice. Yeah, we've got a couple hosts here with Second Sight NYC. Chris and Stephanie, their homes pretty much were wrecked up there, at least, you know, 4 feet of water in the house kind of stuff, and they're going through a whole mess with that and having to get it going. Yeah, they had to cancel their show last week, and they'll be up and running this week, hopefully, you know, and they're posting a lot of pictures of their cleanup and everything, and people in the neighborhood and stuff, and yeah, it is, you know, and it sucks to have that kind of stuff happen, you know, as long as you prepare somewhat, you know, for these kind of events, then you'll be set. You'll be all right, at least for a little while, you know. And I know there's a lot of blowholes out there talking about government assistance and all that kind of garbage. Well, you need to help people, you know, and quit blaming people with their handout for being leeches or parasites or whatever they want to categorize them as. You know, shit happens, you know, and you're not going to be ready for long-term effects of those kind of things. And, you know, that it's reared its head, especially during election season here, which I'm thankful I never really got too involved in a whole lot of the election nonsense, because I just checked out this time around. I'm not doing it, you know. Not doing it every couple years and buying into the nonsense. Not doing it, you know, none of the Facebook shenanigans, none of it. I'm not doing none of it. But, I can't pronounce this name in Iceland. Maybe you can.
Reykjavik.
Yes, Reykjavik?
Reykjavik, yeah. It's the capital of Iceland, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they're really screwing up, you know. It really pissed them off, that little country. But you're talking about a home of trolls, goblins, and magical beasts. Go ahead and talk about that.
Well, Reykjavik's a very interesting sort of picturesque place, and it's an area where the old belief systems and customs and myths and, you know, superstitions haven't really changed that much over the centuries. There's still like a deep, long-standing belief pretty much at all levels throughout Reykjavik and Iceland in the existence of creatures that broadly become known as elementals, that, you know, in simplistic terms, we've sort of relegated them to the realm of like fairies, goblins, gnomes, which have become more sort of stylized by pop culture than anything else. But, you know, centuries ago, they were sort of perceived as a so-called little people, but they were sort of magical, trickster-like creatures that could be benevolent and malevolent, that were kind of like us, but dwarfish in figure, and that would sort of live in the caves and surfeit and steal babies and things like that. And, but today, you know, we sort of view them as sort of fluttering winged fairies and that kind of thing, which, you know, wasn't the original picture of how they looked. But within Iceland, these ancient beliefs and traditions are still very much held, and they, you know, they don't sort of treat these stories lightly. For example, on a number of occasions when they've been building large new highways and roads in Reykjavik and around it, if they come to an area where history's shown that, you know, it was a place of like a magical area where, you know, the little people would surface from, they actually divert the roads around it for fear of creating bad luck. And that's today. You know, you can't imagine building a new road in New York and they actually, you know, curve it around, you know, a distance of 500 feet because goblins were seen there 500 years ago. People would be like, what? But, you know, in Reykjavik, they still hold to those old beliefs. But Reykjavik's interesting again because it also has a lake monster story attached to it, not unlike the Loch Ness monster story, like a long serpent type animal, but it also has a crashed UFO story with some sort of like a cigar shaped object into a particular lake on the fringes of Reykjavik in the early 1950s. What's interesting is that when I was on one trip at the National Archives going through some of the Air Force's old UFO files, I actually got hold of a number of pages of documents on this case, which talks about how the Icelandic military went out there and actually contemplated sort of dragging the river and trying to find if this thing was still there. But because the water was so flowing so quickly, they figured that it was long gone, whatever it was. And, you know, the sheer scale and size of the rivers and lakes, it could have ended up anywhere. But they took it very, very seriously. You know, we're talking about going out with cranes and recovery equipment and all sorts of stuff. So, again, you've got, like, a crashed UFO, a lake monster, the so-called little people and, you know, magical belief systems all focused on the capital of Iceland.
You know, there's a couple places that you didn't put in the book, one of them being the Brown Mountain Lights area out here in North Carolina. Any reason why you snubbed us?
I don't like it. That it's as simple as that. I thought, no, I'm not going to put those guys in. I'm leaving that.
Stupid rednecks, I get it.
No, I mean, joking aside, there were several places where, you know, I included some well-known ones that, like Loch Ness, purely and simply because I was able to add new material. But places like Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where the Mothman was seen, and the Brown Mountain Lights, you know, where you've got the lights, and you also have the famous story, I'm sure you know, like Ralph Lael, you know, the contactee case, that I didn't think there was really anything else I could add that people, particularly from that area, would think, well, hang on, he's just borrowed this and borrowed that. You know what I mean? I don't like to do that. So there were a number of places that I didn't include. You know, it's like with Roswell. Well, that's a well-known one, but I included it because I hardly touched the UFO case and talked about a lot of ghost sightings in town that people don't know anything about. You know, the fact that a lot of haunted buildings in Roswell. So that was kind of the thing with the Brown Mountain Lights, that if I could find more data that the respective researchers in that area hadn't got, I would have thought about doing it. But it's, you know, what's the point of just, you know, sort of copy-pasting your work or somebody else's work and just putting that out, you know.
There you go. Yeah, did the editors and all that tell you what to take out or put in, or they'd leave you wide open to do what you wanted?
No, they didn't take anything out. I mean, obviously your book always goes through an editing process, but I mean, no, they just asked me to come up with my 25 best cases I could think of or find, and the stipulation was, you know, we want you to cover Bigfoot, ghosts, haunted houses, UFOs, paranormal phenomena, strange creatures, you know, portals, doorways, time slips, that kind of thing. There were sort of certain integral key areas, and provided, you know, I covered those, they were cool with it. And, you know, that's something that I heard that often, because people never ask the question, but, I mean, sometimes, you know, the people say, well, what prompted you to write the book? It's like, well, the publisher asked me if I was interested in writing it. Other times, it's because I have a idea I think would make a good book, so I approach them. But it's kind of 50-50, you know, who comes up with the idea. And, you know, and occasionally there have been books where they've said, do you want to write this? And it really, you know, writing it would be like watching paint dry. I'd just, you know, it's like something that I'd have no interest in, and I'd say, no, thanks, it's not really my area. But I've got friends and colleagues who would be the ideal person, because it really is their area. So, you know, I want to write about things I've got a passion for, rather than just trying to up the number of books I've written, do you know what I mean? So.
Yeah, and that's always a good thing, not to do it just to pad the stats, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
To do it because you've got something
I mean,
to say.
Yeah. I don't really want to write a book about something that I have, you know, I couldn't care less about. I mean, what's the point? There is no point, you know.
Yeah, that's for sure. I see you got Mars on here. Jim Mars is another one of, that he wrote some comments about the book. Jim Mars is another one on the list of, like, of people I'd definitely love to have on. And I contacted him earlier this year, but it's been, been rough getting back up with him, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Between about how many times have you been on Coast to Coast, do you think? Because I know you were just on
Coast
like last week, weren't you?
Yeah, probably about 15 over the course of about the last 8 years. I usually get on about twice to three times a year, depending on how many books I've got out. So it's usually averages about twice a year, I would say, something like that.
That's not bad right there. Were you on with John B. Wells, was it, you were on with, or no, you were on with George?
No, actually, I did do it with John, I think, once. I think that's when I did The Men in Black. I did with George Knapp for The World's Weirdest Places. I think I think John was when I did the real Men in Black book, probably about 6 months ago, I think, something like that.
I'm a big fan of John B. Wells, actually, as a host for him. I think it's because of he sounds a lot like Art, you know. But I do like him. I like how he intros the show and says some really cryptic type things, you know, for the most part. I really like that. I dig that stuff, and that's, you know, the way it should be. And I know a lot of people don't care for that and don't care for George these days. And I know Art's been upset. He's been saying some stuff on Facebook, and, you know, who knows? You know, he's been upset about a few things from Coast to Coast, and that's, you know, unfortunate. But, hey, you know, he can always get out there and get in the swing of things and do a show again if he really wanted, you know. And I know Joe Montaldo here extended a hand to see if he wanted to come on and talk to him, and, you know, I haven't heard anything about that. So, you know, like I said, he's got plenty of avenues to go to if he'd like. You know, he's not lacking for friends, you know.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. But go ahead and tell everybody, since we're in our last 5 minutes here, where they can find all your books, where they can find you online, where can they get a hold of Nick Redfern if they don't know already?
Right. Well, people can reach me at Facebook. Just type in Nick Redfern, and they can get me that way. Or they can reach me at the one blog that I update more than any other, which is Nick Redfern, 40, and F-O-R-T-E-A-N, .blogspot.com. Always pleased to chat with people and, you know, answer any questions. I'm not one of these sort of, you know, ego-driven authors who's like, don't talk to me, I'm an author, you know. always pleased to chat with people. Anybody's got any questions? As for the books, people can get them off Amazon or You can get them off the shelves in Barnes and Noble, places like that.
And your blogs that are active?
Yeah, nickredfern14.blogspot.com or nickredfernbooks.blogspot.com. I also write for CryptoMundo, which is a cryptozoology site, cryptomundo.com, and
yes,
also for Mysterious Universe, which is an Australian site I do a couple of articles per week for.
Nice, gotta love it. Yeah, I'd love to have you back on and talk about you know, the Men in Black, a lot of conspiracy stuff. See, that's something that I love more than anything. You know, the UFO and the conspiracy stuff is what I really dig, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's, you know, the crypto stuff and the paranormal stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like it's hard to get conspiracy people on to talk, you know.
Well, I think one of the reasons is, I mean, it's like with me. I mean, I deal with UFO conspiracies, but, I mean, if you ask me to talk about, you know, I don't know, 9/11 or, you know, some, I don't know, genetic modification of food or the Bilderbergers, you know, I know nothing about those things, really, unfortunately, because, you know, they're so in-depth and intricate, that, and there's a lot of good people. You know, like Jim Mars has done a lot of research into the whole 9/11 thing and the Kennedy assassination. You know, for me to sort of go stumbling into these areas now, it's like, what's the point? You know, you're only going to repeat what everybody else has done. So I like to focus on UFOs and crypto stuff. And I think a lot of people in the conspiracy field, you know, they're more inclined to stick with their stuff. I don't think those paths kind of cross too often, really.
Yeah, that's for sure. Definitely. Nicole, are you still there?
I am, actually.
Yeah, a lot of them don't like to intermingle with their
Why did you ask if I was still here?
I'm just checking.
What is this, roll call?
Yes. It is. Through your job.
Did I pack?
No, I don't know. Did you?
I don't know.
You're awake, at least. That's always nice.
It's the first time in weeks that I've made it through a whole show.
That is good. I don't think you even asked a question in the second half. Do you have any questions or anything?
No, I preferred to talk about zombies. That was fun for me.
You know, the .22 caliber is the preferred zombie killing bullet, by the way. And
but I remember
survivalists.
That.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a small bullet, but it gets the job done. It'll still go through a brain, and you can carry a whole lot of it, and it's cheap. You know, and it don't weigh a ton, like I was saying. You know, now I know why. You know.
But don't forget, that's okay if they're the slow walking zombies, but not the fast running ones, you know. And you've got to be a bit more on your aware, you know what I mean?
That's right. You got to slow them down, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like the fast moving zombie movies. That's just not going to work for me. I got to keep it to usual canon, you know.
Dude, that's like the I Am Legend zombies. Those ones, those are horrifying.
Nice. There you go. And I think that about wraps us up for our last minute here. I want to thank you coming on, Nick, and put a little difficulty early on, but, you know, we'll beat technology's ass someday.
Yeah, well, don't worry about that. I had a good time. So,
cool.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
No problem. Thanks for coming on. Like I said,
cool,
we'll drop a line.
Have a good night.
Talk about the other stuff, you know.
All right, cool. Sounds good.
Nice. Thank you. All right, have a good one. And
you too, guys.
Yep. And that's our show for tonight, Nicole.
Is it?
Yeah, you made it.
I made it. I'm kind of proud of myself.
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous you didn't ask any questions.
I'm tired. I did my best.
Yeah, well, your best sucks.
Well,
just for the record. For the record, your best is pathetic. Your best is bad.
I'm tired.
So,
can we have a show earlier? Like, 6
can I get
PM.
Out of this show without you talking
anymore? Like a 6 p.m. show.
Thanks for joining us on the Mind Cemetery. You can find us at mindcemetery.com. Look up our archive on UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Ian in the chat room said I'm broadcasting for 2 now.
We're also eating for 2. Just saying. Pounding a box of cereal a day is ridiculous.
Good night, everyone.
Yes, good night. See you next week. Radio Network on
Twitter and Facebook. And I think that about covers us. We are on, for everybody who just jumped on here at 11 o'clock expecting us to be here, we're on at 9 o'clock now. We just have to update our promos sometime in the near future.
Ooh. I'm glad you said that. I don't know if I updated the schedule. Shit, I need to get a check on that. I don't know if I did that or not. Well, no, that'll make a damn difference.
Really?
That came into play when I was in my late teens.
For Stone and Clifford's excellent books, of course. UFOs are real, extraterrestrial encounters documented by the U.S. government. He also has a prior outstanding book.
That